universe. Once you feel this connectedness and realize that you are not merely a solitary human being, but an integral part of the complex weave of nature, you may discover that your true self knows no limitations. By tapping into the energy within your true self, you can achieve anything you wish, be it wealth and success or spiritual development. But in order to connect to your true self, you must first dissolve the ego. As long as you identify with your ego, you will continue to think of yourself as separate from the rest of the universe, a mere brain inside a physical body, confined and limited. And due to this restricted point of view, you will continue to be fearful, obsessed with survival, and focused on external things such as social status and how other people view you. When your ego is in charge, you lose your connection with your true self and, with that, the endless field of potential energy. Fortunately, you can always reconnect with your true self by practicing silent meditation. To do this, calmly focus your attention on your breathing and observe your thoughts without judgment. Gradually, you will become peaceful, and when your mind and body become still, your ego dissolves, allowing you to reconnect with your true self. People spend a lot of time and energy worrying about the circumstances they find themselves in. For instance, a man might fret about being partnerless, but then, when he enters a relationship, new worries arise. For example, is this relationship now limiting his freedom? Is he truly in love? Thankfully, there is a solution to this problem of chronic fretting. You can simply accept your current situation. For example, imagine living with a difficult roommate. She never cleans up after herself, yet gets angry when you leave the place a mess. This is a tricky situation, one that may make you consider moving out. But moving takes time and money, so what is the best way to resolve the issue now? The answer? Do not fight the problem. Instead, face it and accept it for what it is. There is always a lesson to be learned from difficult situations, and the people who make life difficult are usually there to teach you something. In this case, the lesson might be about standing up for yourself or learning how to be less affected by the actions and opinions of others. Only by accepting this situation can you begin to learn from it and grow. You can take this acceptance a step further and save energy by practicing defenselessness. Practicing defenselessness essentially means getting rid of the need and desire to convince others that your opinion is right or that theirs is wrong. For example, you've probably witnessed diet-related confrontations between vegetarians and omnivores. Before long, the conversation can escalate into a full-blown argument about the ethics in regard to poultry farming. Not only is there a waste of energy, it will inevitably end with both parties more entrenched in their own positions than before. Defenselessness, in contrast, erases the need to convince others of your viewpoint. It allows for a true exchange of ideas about a topic without anger or dogmatism getting in the way. In the above example, defenselessness would mean both parties could openly share their thoughts on their dietary choices without feeling that the other is judging them, and hence without becoming defensive and hostile. Let us say you've always dreamed of owning a Ferrari. You imagine that once you've saved up enough money and bought your dream car, your life will be happy and fulfilling. Chances are, however, that such ardent attachment to the car will only lead to your feeling terribly distressed. Attachment to material things implies distrust in the universe, and this inevitably leads to anxiety. After all, a life spent amassing wealth and material goods as a means to security will end in a disheartening realization. Material possessions can never truly provide safety or security. For example, no matter how much money you save, all can be lost in an economic downturn. Just think of those who lost their homes and savings as a result of the 2008 financial crisis. Real security can be achieved in only one way, by recognizing your true self. By recognizing your true nature, you will find that even fear of death disappears. The body and mind dissolve, and your true self will remain in the field of energy that gives birth to all new life in the universe. While it might sound counterintuitive, you'll also find that your desires can only become reality when you detach yourself from them. For example, single people are often obsessively attached to finding a mate, keeping an eye out for hours on end every day, whether online, at parties, or in their circle of friends or colleagues. Ironically enough, it is usually only when these people, exhausted and discouraged, let go of their ego and give up that the universe gets a chance to step in. Then, as if by magic, the right people finally cross paths. This is what happens when you detach yourself from your desires and connect to the field of energy that is the true nature of the universe, which alone has the power to make our desires become a reality. If you have a large savings account, then you may have received praiseworthy pats on the back from fellow materialists. But rather than saving up, a better path to success is to let your money flow into the world. Hoarding money interrupts the universe's natural flow of give and take. In fact, the Latin root of the word currency literally means to circulate or flow. This shows that even ancient Greek and Roman civilizations understood that money must flow for a society and its people to flourish. This is why investments are often more profitable than savings. For example, say you spent your life earning minimum wage, putting the majority of your monthly paycheck into the bank. Even though the balance of your account will increase, you will not become rich. But if you invest your money in yourself, say in continuing your education and taking the right classes, you could eventually become the CEO of your own business. By wisely investing in your education, far more will flow back to you, leaving you with more money than a lifetime of petty savings ever could. This spiritual law of giving and receiving does not only apply to money either. It applies to love, friendship, support, and all the things we exchange socially. If you use this social currency to give others what you hope to receive, you will be amply rewarded. The more love people give within a society, the more that love will be shared with others and will continue to grow. But, naturally, this only works if everyone is prepared to give as well as receive. For example, most people desire a partner who will love them and take care of them. But many forget that a relationship is also about giving love and caring for someone else. If everyone were focused solely on getting love and not giving it, we would all end up lonely and quite unhappy. We all know the advertising slogan, "Just do it." Live in the moment, it tells us, seize the opportunity. But to truly get the most out of life, rather than just doing something, it is important to consider what the most beneficial choice is when making a decision. This is what it means to be conscious of your choice making. After all, we all make choices all the time, sometimes without even knowing we are doing it. In fact, most of our choices are unconscious. For example, when you are shopping, you might buy bags full of junk food without considering the impact they have on your health or the environment. Unfortunately, such unconscious behavior comes naturally to us, since our survival instinct tells us to stock up on large quantities of cheap food. So, in order to make good choices, pause and consider the impact your actions have on both you and others. How might you avoid habitually purchasing junk food? Well, first off, consider your budget, and then, within its constraints, choose products that are the most beneficial to your health and that during the production process have done the least harm to other people, animals, and the environment. To continue making good choices in your everyday life, simply choose the actions that will bring the most joy and goodwill to others. In some cases, the choice might seem obvious. For example, if you are invited to a birthday party but decide that it is too much of an inconvenience to attend, you should realize that you are only considering your own needs. So instead, recognize the pleasure that the host will enjoy by being surrounded by friends on their special day. In other cases, the choice might be more subtle. If someone insults you, for example, you have two options. You can be hurt by the remark and retaliate, or you can refuse to let it affect you. By choosing the second option, you both avoid subjecting yourself to unpleasant emotions and treat the offender as you would want to be treated yourself. Does the idea of accepting your current situation make you anxious? Perhaps because you are unhappy and do not want to accept how things are? Well, don't worry. The good news is that your thoughts have the power to change the world around you. You can improve your quality of life by simply introducing positive intentions into your thinking. The positivity that goes into these thoughts is all part of the infinite field of potential energy that governs the universe. So, by introducing an intention or wish into this field of energy, you affect the universe around you. Let us say you'd like to have a beautiful home, but you often think about this in a negative way. Your emotions are tied up in disliking your current home and thinking that you'll never have sufficient funds to afford the one you want. When you do this, you give negative energy to the universe. Naturally, this will not result in the universe giving back positive energy. So, instead, accept and be grateful for the home you do have, and visualize the changes that could make your living situation even better. The universe will pick up on these positive thoughts and turn them into reality. To turn these desires into reality, however, you must give the process your full attention. For example, if you are dissatisfied with your job, you may have negative thoughts about being incompetent or feeling unworthy. It requires constant attention throughout the day to notice these negative patterns and replace them with positive ones. If you catch yourself thinking that you are not contributing enough at work, stop yourself and consciously think about your accomplishments to find at least one constructive thing you've done. Even if it is as simple as having written a carefully worded and effective email, you can stay with this positive thought to remain positive throughout the day. Every human wants to shine. But, as each star has its right place in the night sky, every human must find their right place on Earth. Only by doing this, and by helping others find their place, will people flourish and lead a purposeful existence. So, ask not what the universe can do for you, but what you can do for the universe. Let us say that you have always dreamed of becoming an artist. After all, it is a wonderful profession, and you admire the special kind of talent it takes to create art that inspires people and makes them happier and wiser. But the truth is, not everyone is artistically talented, and if this is the case for you, you might end up sad or depressed, feeling that you cannot contribute anything of value to society. But do not despair. Instead of clinging to these dreams, be honest with yourself and discover the truth within that can serve and benefit others. While a creative person will probably become a good artist or designer, a compassionate person might be better off as a doctor or nurse. It is never too late to recognize your life's purpose and plug into the endless source of energy that is the universe. You might now be wondering whether your current job is providing you with the best possible way to contribute to the welfare of humanity and the planet. As it turns out, there is an easy way to tell. When you've found the right job, you will discover that you have a nearly endless source of energy to complete your work. This is the feeling you get when you align with the cosmic plan that was your destiny from the very beginning. The universe begins to support you and provide you with the energy you need, which explains how some people can work effortlessly and happily for long hours, while others feel drained after just a few hours in the office. What do you think? Have you found your true self? Final summary. Human beings are not separate, powerless egos that are lost and alone in a harsh physical world. Every one of us is part of the infinite field of potential energy that gives birth to and governs everything in the universe. When you recognize this, you can use this energy to fulfill your personal and professional dreams. This concludes The 7 Spiritual Laws of Success by Deepak Chopra. Happiness by Richard Layard. In Happiness, economist Richard Layard examines what it is that makes us happy and how anyone can achieve greater happiness, basing his studies on insights from such diverse fields as psychology, philosophy, and neuroscience. Layard presents compelling arguments that are great food for thought, encouraging readers to question their daily habits and practices. The pursuit of happiness is as old as humankind. Only recently, however, have scientists and researchers begun to examine exactly what it is that makes us happy. That is where Richard Layard's happiness comes in. In his best-selling book, the famed British economist presents and investigates much of this research and shows that, while money and material wealth can bring great happiness to people in more poor countries, wealth has no such power in the already abundant Western and developed world. Layard also uses research in neuroscience to demonstrate that the human search for happiness is fundamental and innate. Even infants respond with happiness or unhappiness to certain stimuli that our brains are hardwired to respond to. In this book, you'll find out why happy people are less likely to suffer from numerous diseases and health problems, like heart attacks, and more likely to have stronger bones and better skin. You will learn why the pursuit of happiness is behind every decision you make. Finally, you will discover why higher progressive taxation is arguably a key factor in increasing people's overall happiness. Most of us believe that happiness is this mysterious phenomenon, a feeling or state of being that eludes measurement and explanation. Yet, in fact, there are several scientific ways to measure happiness. In most studies, participants are asked to simply assess how happy they are with their life situation in general. For instance, the General Social Survey, a longitudinal study conducted in the United States, asks participants the following. Taken altogether, how would you say things are these days? Would you say that you are very happy, pretty happy, or not too happy. The resulting data of such studies suggests that the average rating of U.S. citizens' happiness has not significantly increased since 1945. Clearly, such studies depend on rather subjective assessments of one's own happiness. However, neuroscientists have also experimented with more objective methods. Using EEG, for instance, they were able to identify certain areas of the brain that were active whenever subjects were happy or when they encountered things associated with increased happiness, like receiving a gift or compliment, or when presented with images of people they were friends with or people they liked. Such studies have revealed that positive feelings, such as pride, joy, or gratefulness, usually correspond to greater activity in the left frontal area of the brain. In contrast, negative emotions like fear, anxiety, or anger are linked with the right frontal area. The EEG approach can even work with infants. When they suck on sweet foods, their brain's left frontal area is activated. Sour tastes, on the other hand, lead to greater activity in the front right area of the brain. Moreover, it is even possible to directly induce human emotions. For example, experiments have demonstrated that stimulating the left frontal part of the brain with a strong magnet can automatically lift a person's mood. Being happy does not just put a smile on your face, it is also beneficial to your physical health. Whenever we experience positive emotions, our brains release certain neurotransmitters, also known as happiness hormones, which have been shown to have a positive effect on many of our bodily functions. While being happy results in greater levels of these hormones, it also leads to lower levels of the stress hormone cortisol. Cortisol has a negative impact on our immune system, causes us to age more rapidly, and actually thins our skin and weakens our bones. Increasing one's happiness thus means less stress, and less stress means better health. As a consequence, happy people have a stronger immune system, preventing them from catching a common cold and other diseases. Moreover, even if happy people do become sick, they tend to recover more quickly and have fewer symptoms than unhappy people do. More significantly, happiness also decreases the risk of suffering from more severe health conditions. For example, one longitudinal study showed that happier people are at a lower risk of having a heart attack. They were also shown to be at a lower risk of developing restricted blood flow in their arteries, a high risk factor for heart attacks. In general, experiencing happiness tends to have extremely positive effects on our overall health and increases our general well-being. For example, one survey of 750 actors nominated for an Oscar showed that the nominees who had actually won the coveted award went on to live an average of 4 years longer than those who had lost. There are many more examples that prove the point. Experiencing happiness does not just feel good, it is also good for your health. Think back to the last time you made a decision. Now ask yourself, what led me to make that particular choice? Like most people, whenever you have to make a decision, you tend to choose the option that leads you to your greatest happiness and well-being, whether that decision concerns what to eat for dinner, which job to take, or your next holiday destination. why. First, the pursuit of happiness, the desire to be safe and well, is one of the main innate drivers of our human behavior. Indeed, it has developed over the course of human evolution. The capacity for happiness evolved in our ancestors so they could differentiate between behavior that was good or bad for their survival and reproduction. For example, eating foods rich in calories made them feel happy, as did mating. Thus, today, most of the things that bring us happiness, such as eating, sex, good friendships, were at some point crucial to human survival and for the transfer of genes from generation to generation. Similarly, those things that cause us to feel unhappy, like hunger, thirst, loneliness, or being poisoned, were detrimental to our survival. Consequently, we developed emotions to signal that we should avoid situations that would cause unhappiness. Take fear, for example. Fear helped our ancestors avoid dangerous situations, such as facing a predator, and hence to avoid the risk of being killed. In their hostile environment, our ancestors' capacity for experiencing fear was an essential attribute to survival. For example, people who ran away from hungry, saber-toothed tigers lived longer than those who attempted to pet them. Hence, both the pursuit of happiness and the avoidance of unhappiness were part of our ancestors' survival strategy, and the pursuit of happiness remains a strong determinant of our behavior. Even if today, very few of us are at risk to being devoured by saber-toothed tigers. We tend to believe that, as Western societies have progressed in many ways, our happiness has increased too. Yet, since the 1950s, most people in the Western world have not gotten any happier. In fact, the average income in the United States has doubled since the 1950s, and, with it, the average standard of living. However, surveys have not found that more people describe themselves as happy. Clearly, the increase in wealth did not automatically lead to an increase in happiness. This can be seen in most European countries too. The average income continues to grow, yet this does not appear to make people happier. Furthermore, despite vastly improved economic circumstances, increasing numbers of people are suffering from depression and alcoholism. In fact, in the United States and other Western countries, major depressions were at their most prevalent during the economic growth of the 1960s and 1970s. The same is true of alcohol consumption. With the exception of France, there has been a reported dramatic increase in the amount of alcohol consumed in most countries. In Germany, for example, alcohol consumption has quadrupled since the 1950s. Finally, in the latter half of the 20th century, statistics show that crime has increased significantly. Indeed, between 1950 and 1980, crime has increased by a massive 300% in most countries, despite the strong economic growth and exponentially low unemployment rate. This includes all types of crime: fraud, violence, burglary, car theft, and so on. Because of the increase in crime, people began to report that they felt unsafe in their own cities and that they trusted other people less. Furthermore, this decrease in happiness is evident in the fact that the disintegration of families has become more and more common. Would you rather live in a world where you earn more money than you do today, but even less money than everyone else? Or one where you earn less than you do today, but more than everyone else? Given the choice, most people would prefer to live in the latter world. But why? Humans are a competitive species, predisposed to compare themselves to their neighbors, siblings, and colleagues. So, while the absolute figure on your paycheck does not necessarily lead to greater happiness, having an income that is relatively higher than other people's does make a difference. That is because people who earn more than their colleagues are more likely to feel respected and valuable. In contrast, those earning less than others, particularly their peers, tend to feel worthless and unhappy. In societies where individuals are encouraged into fierce competition with each other, many people feel as if they are in a rat race. In this futile, seemingly endless pursuit, individuals try to outperform others who, in turn, attempt to outperform them as well. The result? No one gets anywhere, at least on a relative scale. As a concrete example, consider the reunification of Germany. The effects of the reunification on people from the former East was that, though their wealth and standard of living increased dramatically, their confidence took a nosedive. That is because they had become accustomed to comparing themselves to the people of other socialist countries in Eastern Europe, who were even more poor than them. Hence, they felt relatively rich and prosperous. But, with Germany's reunification, they began to compare themselves with the wealthier Western Germans, and were left feeling relatively poor. Like other animals, humans quickly become accustomed to new stimuli, environments, and circumstances. We get used to the new people in our lives, such as a new spouse. We get used to becoming parents, and of course, we get used to having a bigger house or higher income. For this reason, winning the lottery, receiving a sizable bonus at work, or finding a new job that offers you more money only bring temporary happiness. Even though you have achieved something positive in your life, the positive emotions you are rewarded with will fade as you become accustomed to the new status quo. Indeed, you ultimately end up feeling only as happy as you were before your good fortune. Becoming accustomed to any gains in your life, for instance, a higher standard of living, drives you to want increasingly more of everything just so you can experience another small but temporary happiness boost that will leave you longing for the next. The result? You will wind up needing more and more just to maintain that same level of temporary happiness. Hence, we are driven to work more so we can earn more, and to earn more so we can buy more and consume more, all with the goal of attaining permanent happiness. Yet, because we get used to everything we gain, this approach is futile. As with any drug, a little kick or a hit is short-lived. A high simply cannot last forever, and thus cannot lead to a state of permanent happiness. To use a metaphor, it is like trying to win a race by running faster, then realizing that you're actually running in a hamster wheel. Much like Alice learns from the Red Queen in Alice Through the Looking Glass, running gets us nowhere. It takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place. If you want to get somewhere else, you must run at least twice as fast as that. On average, people in the wealthier nations of the Western world are happier than those living in poor, developing countries. This is also evident in countries that were once much poorer, but that have gained some wealth in recent decades, like India, Mexico, Brazil, and South Korea. In these countries, as the average wealth increased, so did people's reported levels of happiness. Why is this? The reason is simple. Being poor, fearing for your life and lacking the material basis to sustain your family are hugely detrimental to happiness. Increasing people's income in such cases of extreme poverty leads to increased happiness because getting rid of this lack of the basic means of survival results in a great pain being lifted. For instance, if an increase in wealth means that you do not have to worry about your children starving to death every day, it will have relieved you of a profoundly heavy burden, and thus dramatically increase your happiness. However, as we have already seen, wealth and happiness do not necessarily go hand in hand. Past a certain point, the positive effects of money on happiness comes to a halt. As studies suggest, beyond an annual salary of around $20,000, happiness stops increasing in correlation with higher income. The lesson is clear. While in the poorest countries, money has the power to dramatically increase happiness, in the developed world, where most of the population have a satisfactory level of wealth, money obviously is not the key to achieving the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people. What, then, is the key? How can we in the West increase our happiness in the long term? Since 1981, the World Values Survey has asked more than 350,000 people in 50 countries about their general happiness. The resulting data show that the following five factors, in descending order, have the strongest influence on our overall well-being. Number one, family relationships and our close private life. Number two, our financial situation, especially for those at risk of poverty. Number three, our work as something which gives our life purpose. Number four, community and friends as a source of trust and belonging. Number five, our health, especially for those suffering from severe illnesses and most extremely in cases of mental disorder. As many studies indicate, family is the most important factor in our happiness, much more so than our financial situation. For example, going through a divorce has twice the impact on one's level of happiness as losing 30% of one's income. Moreover, married people have been shown to live far longer and to enjoy much healthier lives. Our work and social environment also have been shown to have a strong impact on our well-being. For instance, losing a job is often a devastating experience, leading to diminished self-confidence and self-worth. These losses are far more important to one's well-being than the mere loss of income. Furthermore, our work and the community we belong to give our lives purpose. True companionship and a sense of belonging are two of the most positive things that people can experience in their lives. Next, aside from health, two other factors appear to have a significant impact: personal freedom and personal values. People who live in stable and peaceful countries where they are free to pursue their interests are reported to be happier than those living in restricted societies. People who have their own personal values are shown to be happier. For instance, those with positive philosophies of life, such as religious people, who value their lives and appreciate what they have. As we have learned, even though material wealth has steadily increased, people have not become happier in the last 50 years. One reason for this might be that our governments are simply pursuing the wrong objective. economic growth has been the central goal of all Western societies in the past decades, while factors known to be crucial to our happiness, like family, friends, and health, have been left by the wayside, even though the notion has been obsolete for a very long time, Western governments still seem to believe that if the economy grows, people will be happier. But why? Following the Second World War, when many people were poor and craved material possessions and wealth, using a country's GDP as the main indicator of its population's well-being seemed quite appropriate. Yet, in today's world of relative abundance, the health of a Western country's GDP does not correspond to the happiness, needs, and desires of its people. Therefore, politicians should attempt to discover what the people of today actually need rather than satisfying the needs of generations long since past. To that end, any fixation on increasing material wealth should be jettisoned, as we have learned that we already have everything we need to lead happier lives. For instance, family, social bonds, and meaningful work. If this seems wrong or wildly unrealistic to you, just take a look at the tiny Himalayan kingdom of Bhutan. Since the 1970s, Bhutan's main objective has not been the gross national product, but the gross national happiness. To this end, Bhutan's wealth is redistributed in order to minimize extreme poverty and status competition among the population. According to the author, the people of Bhutan appear to be far happier than people living anywhere else. Would you agree that greater happiness can be reached by increasing taxation? If your answer is no, you are not alone in that opinion. However, consider what would happen if taxes were high and got higher the more people earned. The result would be people being discouraged from seeking happiness where it cannot be found. A higher, progressive income tax would lead people to work less and devote more time to their families and other proven sources of happiness. It would also discourage them from focusing on money, which, as we have seen, is not the path to increased happiness. Also, higher, progressive taxation would help reduce people's competitive drive and diminish their tendency to compare themselves to others. Indeed, working less hours and focusing less on money enables greater happiness. We already do more work than is good for us and spend too little time on those things that truly matter for our well-being, such as spending time with family and friends. Higher taxation would therefore cause many people to achieve a much healthier work-life balance. Also, with higher progressive taxation, the futility of always hunting for the next high is made obvious, and therefore we avoid the unhappiness that results from getting used to whatever fleeting pleasure we might gain. In short, higher taxes make the extra work necessary to win the next small raise seem pointless, thus making it easier to simply spend more time outside of work. Finally, the drive to compete with others in terms of income is a zero-sum game. When one gains the advantage, another loses, so the overall happiness effect is leveled out at zero. Therefore, taxes that make it difficult to earn more than others effectively put a stop to the rat race, making greater happiness a possibility for all. As we have seen, the primary source of happiness is family. But what can governments do in this regard? Quite a lot, it appears. For instance, they could make our working environments more family-friendly by enforcing flexible working hours and parental leave, establishing mandatory child care in offices, and so on. One proven way to encourage people to spend more time with those who make them happy is to reduce commute times and the continual switching of workplaces. Always being on the move makes it harder for people to establish stable relationships and friendships, and to truly belong to a functioning community. Governments could thus offer incentives that encourage working people to remain close to family and friends. Governments should also try to minimize unemployment, as being unemployed causes much unhappiness, damages self-esteem, and if people fear unemployment and have to work hard to avoid it, that harms society as a whole. Therefore, a government that wants its citizens to be happy should ensure that the unemployed are offered jobs. Also, governments should prioritize prevention and treatment of mental disorders, as they are one of the greatest sources of unhappiness that still are not given enough attention. For instance, in the United States, a mere 7% of healthcare funds is allocated to mental health. The situation is not much better in Europe, with just 11% spent on mental health care in Germany and 13% in the UK. Final summary. While wealth has steadily increased for decades in the Western world, people's overall happiness has not. Hence, if we want to truly be happy, we should stop focusing on acquiring wealth and material possessions and start paying more attention to the things that actually make us happier. Friends, family, meaningful work, and health. This concludes Happiness by Richard Layard. Mindful Work by David Gellis. Mindful Work provides an introduction to why and how mindfulness is practiced in the West today, on an individual as well as professional level. Using examples from well-known companies, it explains the benefits that mindfulness can offer you, the people around you, and the environment. We are all in this stressful and crazy world together, a world that is moving so fast that you cannot keep up with everything and everyone. How many times a day do you think, I need to calm down, and before you know it, you're Googling for cheap tickets to the Bahamas? But wait, there is a cheaper way to go about it. You do not have to run away or jump on a plane every time you feel completely burned out. In fact, you don't even have to leave your workplace to refresh your focus and sustain your otherwise great ability to solve problems. Here is the key: mindfulness. Many companies have already opened up to the idea of mindfulness and how it might benefit their work culture and thus business in general. And that is exactly what this book will teach you. You will learn great insights into mindfulness, the way it works, and who, aside from yourself and your business, is benefiting from it. For many people, work hours have become blurred, and things like checking business emails outside of office hours have become commonplace. With this change, stress has become a considerable risk, not only to employees, but to large companies. Shockingly, according to the World Health Organization, stress costs American businesses as much as $300 billion per year. To deal with this challenge, more and more companies are catching on to mindfulness. You can think of mindfulness as the easiest form of meditation. Basically, it means paying attention to the present moment and noticing your thoughts without judgment. So, how does mindfulness relate to work? Simply put, it makes dealing with issues at work easier. Mindfulness has many benefits, which we will delve into in this book, but what all of these benefits have in common is that they make us more self-aware, train our focus, and increase clarity, all of which are valuable qualities to have in the workplace. Mindfulness allows you to step back from the problem and observe it so you can deal with it more objectively and reach solutions more easily. For example, working with a colleague who slacks off can make you livid, but being mindful can help you realize the reasons for their behavior. Perhaps they are tired because they have a newborn baby, and talking to them about it can solve the problem. As a new generation of companies start to understand the benefits of mindfulness, a mindful work culture is already gaining momentum. Even multinational companies have caught on. General Mills, for example, was a pioneer in providing mindfulness training during work hours. The training was initiated by Janice Martorano, who began practicing mindfulness after dealing with personal and professional stress. Soon, hundreds of General Mills employees were participating, and now every single building in the General Mills business has a meditation room. Up until the 1990s, it was difficult for fans of mindfulness to get others on board with the idea. The effects that they were experiencing with the technique was not quantifiable, and there was no scientific study to support the practice. However, since the invention of functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI, a technology that can measure brain activity through blood flow, the benefits of mindfulness can now be scientifically proven. By using fMRIs, scientists can demonstrate that when we meditate, the area of our brain responsible for thinking about ourselves becomes significantly calmer. Experiments have also shown that when someone carries out a task that makes them think about their own thoughts or behavior, such as highlighting a word that describes themselves in a text, and then follow up with a mindfulness exercise, the brain's reactions to similar situations that involve self-reflection are gradually reduced. This means that with time, those who practice mindfulness can decrease the degree to which they are judgmental because the brain has practiced being more objective. Another benefit to mindfulness is that it shapes our brains. Our brains are not rigid structures. A brain can, in fact, change a great deal. It can be trained like a muscle and altered by repeated thought processes. This quality is known as neuroplasticity. Research has shown that mindfulness increases activity in the brain's prefrontal cortex, heightening our kindness and compassion. It also strengthens our cortical thickness, or gray matter, which aids memory function and emotion regulation. Perhaps the most noteworthy finding, however, relates to the amygdala. In stressful situations, such as a job interview, our fight-or-flight response is triggered by the amygdala. This is obviously an overreaction, as the days of having to run from or face and kill an animal predator are largely gone. When we practice mindfulness, the amygdala gradually relaxes in the long run, which helps us keep stress at bay. As more studies and more high-profile people like Steve Jobs began to endorse mindfulness, people started paying more attention. But it wasn't until one man in particular began tailoring mindfulness practices to Western culture that it really gained popularity. During the late 1970s, Jon Kabat-Zinn developed a method called Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, or MBSR. MBSR is independent of any religious belief and is based on training the attention with the goal of becoming fully present and focusing on the physical sensations in the body. For example, one exercise involves noticing if you are experiencing pain anywhere or if parts of your body feel relaxed. After a few repetitions, you will begin to realize that pain and relaxation are not constant, but continually changing in intensity. In this way, MBSR trains your self-awareness. Applied to stress, this means observing your thoughts and physical reactions and watching as they dissipate. By observing your reactions objectively, you'll come to learn that no pain or stress lasts forever. With Kabat-Zinn's MBSR, mindfulness and meditation entered mainstream culture, offering an effective solution to the ubiquitous problem of stress. As we've seen, mindfulness is about observing your thoughts and emotions and deciding what to concentrate on. Focusing on one thing at a time is far more efficient than multitasking, and mindfulness is great at helping you do just that. At work in particular, we are bombarded with stimuli such as multiple computer screens, which cause perpetual distractions. So, how do we react? By multitasking. However, contrary to popular belief, this is not a productivity booster. Instead, it means we are frantically jumping from one task to another. Furthermore, multitasking adds more opportunities for your mind to wander as you consider what to do next. It is far more effective to figure out in which order things should be done and then tackling them one at a time. Say, for instance, you start thinking about what you should do next at work. Thoughts like, I need to pick up some groceries, or I have to confirm my reservation at the restaurant, will start sneaking in because they are also on your to-do list. Thankfully, as mindfulness develops your focus, your ability to direct your attention will slowly become automatic, and knowing how to prevent your mind from chasing every thought you have means you'll be less easily distracted. But how do you train your attention? Well, be it at your desk, a basketball game, or talking with a colleague, you must observe your thoughts so you can bring yourself back into focus. For example, when National University professor Mason Fries was a college wrestler, he was about to win a match against a former national champion. But when he got his opponent onto the mat, thoughts like, "I can't win, he was a national champion," began to creep in his mind, and he lost his grip. If he had focused on the moment, it would have helped him, and he could have won the match. Have you ever noticed that people who practice mindfulness not only seem to be calmer, but also kinder and more open? This is because mindfulness nurtures a sense of self-compassion and connectedness to others. As you learn to observe your emotions in a non-judgmental way, you'll start to see that feelings like frustration are natural and that we all have a bad day now and again. Once you get this level of compassion down, you will feel a sense of relief as you learn to accept negative emotions and open up to joy and empathy. As it develops, it begins to radiate outward towards people around you, enabling you to relate to their problems and emotions in a more empathetic, non-judgmental way. This can be referred to as a sense of common humanity or social connectedness. This sense of connectedness to others can be strengthened using a special meditation called metta, or loving kindness. Metta involves wishing yourself happiness, protection, and freedom from harm. As you train these feelings toward yourself, you can start to wish them upon people directly around you, other people you know, and finally, everyone in the world. Some people view compassion as something soft or weak, but it actually makes you stronger. It means being more aware of the feelings of others and wanting to prevent them from experiencing pain. For example, police officer Sherry Maples always used to become stressed and aggressive when she was called out on the job. But practicing mindfulness changed her perspective, and she started to see the call as an opportunity to help rather than an opportunity to become stressed. Of course, mindfulness is not a magic wand that makes all of our problems disappear, but it does make us more aware of our own and others' feelings. Because of this, it makes us more tolerant, loving, and kind. Because it involves you and everyone around you, mindfulness can be applied directly to your work, fostering compassion for others and the world beyond. Businesses with a mindful culture are likely to act responsibly when it comes to the environment. When you practice mindfulness for long enough, you'll start to realize that you are not only responsible for yourself, but in part for society as well. For example, outdoor clothing brand Patagonia tries to inform their customers about mindful consumption as they want to lessen negative impacts on their environment. They even began one of their campaigns by